Clustered Conversations. Clustered Conversations. By Weka.
All right. Hey, welcome back to Clustered Conversations. I'm Bob.
And I'm Josh.
And today we're joined by Tom Taylor. Tom is one of our partners slash customers, has worked with Weka quite a bit, and just get to know him a little bit today. So, Tom, how about you introduce yourself to the group?
Say hello.
Hi there, guys. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me here. I'm Tom Taylor. I'm the founder of Gunpowder Tech. We're essentially systems integrators who help people navigate the cloud, try and bring their traditional workflows out of their own data centers and into the cloud providers. And super excited to be here. Super happy with my experiences with Weka and just excited to share them.
Awesome.
Awesome. So quick question. What kind of workloads are you seeing kind of moving up? I mean, is it media entertainment? Is it financial? What is it that you're mostly seeing or are you more focused on?
We really focus in on images, right? So whether that's architectural or gaming or VFX, whether that's advertising or long form, you know, our customer base are people who need GPU spec workstations with central storage, traditionally Linux environments, who have a big fat render farm behind it, either working on-prem or within the cloud providers. So it really is quite a wide gamut of who our target audience is. Our bread and butter really is VFX because that's kind of where my experience comes from. I've been working in VFX about 20 years. I'm originally South African and I started work at a post place over there, coming from corporate IT, and I fell in love with the fact that I didn't have to wear a jacket into work every day. In fact, we were encouraged to wear flip-flops or sandals. I'm not sure, depending on where you're on the world, that's what the nomenclature is. And I've never looked back. I've just really, really took to the art and took to the VFX world.
Nice.
Wow. Cool.
So what are your favorite tools to use there? Sort of like, you know, are you a Maya guy? Are you an After Effects guy? Are you a... What's Tom's personal preference?
Good question. I mean, you know, being an engineer, you kind of have to know a little bit about every single application. I would say the majority that we see are Maya Arnold-based workflows. But every now and again, we'll get a smattering of an architect who comes in who's got a Windows, you know, Studio Max V-Ray workflow, who's looking to render some stuff. We just did a really, really fun project for an artist called Urs Fischer, who has an exhibition on at the Gagosian in New York. So we got approached and the ask was, hey, we need to spin up 10,000 render nodes with RenderMan. Can you help us? And 10,000 render nodes is larger than I've ever done by a factor of a few zeros. So it was a super, super fun project. We literally broke everything that we put in front of it. You name it, we had to put a load balancer in place.
Nice.
And they were just ramping up and up and up, but it's a super, super impressive piece. If anybody's in New York, I strongly encourage you to go and have a look at it. It's essentially a 10K image on a large screen, with 2,000 objects built in 3D that all sort of interact and refract and reflect. And it's a hell of a lot of rendering.
Wow. Is that like a rendered video sort of on a loop sort of situation, or is it?
It's on a loop, but essentially every single item in this piece is an NFT as well. So the overall piece is an NFT, and then all one of those 2,000 objects you can go off and purchase.
Wow.
Again, super fun project, off the out of the norm for us. You know, traditionally it's like, hey, we want to spin up a Maya studio and we need 20 artists working. This was we've got a single artist who's doing this piece and we really just need all the horsepower in the world behind this.
It sounds like it.
Some fun statistics. I think we were reading off of the cluster at around 400 gigabytes a second, which is the fastest I've seen anything in my life go.
Not bad at all. Yeah, especially in an actual, you know, real workflow. That's impressive.
So I guess which clouds are you most interested in? I mean, which ones are the ones that you really like working with, or, you know, is there a special one, or are you, you know, okay with everybody?
I mean, we're you know, we in my previous role, I had a relationship with everybody. Now we have a relationship with everybody again. We sort of lean towards GCP. We're a build partner in there. We have a product that's essentially a studio in a box that's in the marketplace over there. It sort of allows people to spin up their own studios by purchasing this thing through the marketplace. And what kind of makes us different is we're not a software as a service, so you don't click the button and we disappear. We really customize it and build it for studios so that, you know, no two studios are the same. Everybody's mm-hmm. slightly different, although everybody might still be using Maya. So we kind of sell our systems integration into that, and we built it in a modular fashion. So you can be as a light touch or as heavy touch as our artists or as our customers need. You know, I keep trying to say to everybody, I built a product that I would have sold myself at my previous role being the CTO of the mill. We can't get tied into specific things. We can't get tied into specific vendors. I really want a modular piece of software that ties in with what I've chosen.
Nice. Something that can go everywhere, not, you know, you don't have a long-term relationship, but a long-term sort of contract sticking you with a single
exactly.
vendor, single location.
Yeah. Something that's flexible.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the sort of best promises of the, you know, quote unquote multi-cloud is being able to go to, you know, whichever provider has the features or benefits or relationship that you want to use.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays it's almost a given to, if you're a large company, to be multi-cloud. You know, with GPU availability and hardware availability, a lot of people have pushed their workflows into the cloud. So they're feeling the pinch on availability. And I think if I was starting my own VFX company today, I would try and make sure that I touch as many bases as possible, just to make sure that I can service the work when I need to service the work.
All right, sweet. I mean, so I was curious about a couple of things there. I mean, it sounds like the render workflow is kind of really been good in the recent days about being remote, right? A lot of people working out of their homes or out of their home countries or. How have you seen that as people are coming back to the office? Are you seeing it still stay remote because companies have found that it's just much more efficient, or are they bringing people back into the office and asking for how do we get this stuff, you know, centralized again?
Oh, I mean, that's the multi-million dollar question here. you know, my company exists because of COVID. Yeah. We literally saw a market opportunity and spun up, and we've been benefiting ever since. I think. We can debate this topic till we're blue in the face. You know, I don't know if I have a personal preference or if I'm seeing a particular trend. Mm-hmm. I guess the trend that I'm seeing is a lot of senior management want to get people back into the office, and a lot of the artists want to stay at home. It also depends what department you're in, I find. You know, if you look at traditional advertising, the producers, I felt really sorry for them for COVID because their role is to connect people and their role is to stay on top of people. And what that translated to during COVID was 1,000,001 Zoom meetings every single day. Whereas previously they would have been able to just open a door, pop their head in, ask a question and get a response straight away. For some of the artists, you know, if you're a lead artist, you're almost playing that role of a producer, but you're also holding the timeline and holding the edit. So you need quick answers and you need to be able to have your team around you and be close. But if you're a 3D op working on a shot, the last thing you want is somebody popping their head in and asking you how you're doing. Right. So it really is like a 50-50 split that I've seen of people that want to get back in and people that want to stay remote. Nowadays, I think the key is flexibility. You know, I've definitely seen a lot of online forums and stuff of people saying they refuse to go back into the office, and some people refuse to be remote. So it's a flavor that you kind of have to pick, and you kind of have to pick your favorite. And if you're a management team, you need to try and pick which direction you're going and double down on it and just make sure that you've made the right decision. And there might be some fallout along that way with that decision. You know, so I don't think I can really answer in terms of efficiency or whether or not people have been less or more productive working from home. I think it's all an individual case-by-case basis. You know, my engineers, I particularly hire engineers who I know will be happy working from home and who I know are comfortable. I like to refer to them as responsible adults. You know, I'm not going to micromanage you. I'm not going to sit and make sure you're doing your work every day. Because I whittle that out in the interview process. I want to make sure that my guys are comfortable and happy and kind of self-starters and know what they're doing. And I would hope that any senior management around the world is doing the same thing.
Yeah, so Josh and I are basically been working from home for the most part. And I think even if we had the opportunity to go in the office, we still work from home because we can get so much more done. But in especially in the artist world that you're talking about, even before COVID came, I remember having conversations with a few studios and they were always talking about remote artists, right? Basically going where the artist is, having the data available where the artist is, whether he's in New Mexico or New Zealand, right? Anywhere in the world. Because it's just easier that way to be able to hire an artist than have it who's good rather than finding an artist who's good in a particular geography.
Yeah. Why limit yourself, right, to the specific geo?
That's been the biggest benefit of this pandemic for companies is they've really been able to staff the jobs with the talent they want rather than the talent that's available.
Right.
You know, and the irony is this technology has been around for the last 10 years. When we were at the mill, we had a big data center and we had all our equipment in there. Mm-hmm. They still do. And everybody had a Teradici on their desktop and that's how they would connect. So when the pandemic hit, we got a couple hundred people, well, I think over 1,000 people working remotely in sort of 2 days. We just said to everybody, right, pick up everything you've got in your desk and go home with it and plug it in and carry on working. You know, we really just took that Ethernet cable and extended it over the internet into their houses.
Nice.
So it was relatively easy for us, but there are a lot of people out there that really, really struggled, particularly, you know, the houses that are like the editorial facilities that are built on Macintoshes and maybe the remote software wasn't quite up to par or hadn't quite caught up. But I think, you know, nowadays there's kind of no excuse to not have a solid remote pipeline.
Right.
Was there not much of a difference when you went from, you know, kind of a, you know, a Teradici, you know, PC over IP on a LAN versus now on somebody's WAN connection, who knows where, adding that additional, you know, handful of milliseconds or dozens of milliseconds of latency, did that not have an effect on, you know, workflows or efficiencies?
Well, I always say to everybody, the brain compensates. You know, if you're at home and you've got an additional quarter of a millisecond of latency, your brain compensates for it to a degree, obviously. If there's 10 milliseconds of latency, like, no, you're never going to compensate for that. But if there's a slightly, slightly slower delay, use it for a few hours and you're going to get used to it. You know, it really is one of those things. And the companies have put in a hell of a lot of R&D over the last 2-3 years into their software and into their technology to make it as good as possible. And I think a big shout out to all the artists around the world, because everybody was really accommodating and really understanding with their engineering teams. It was a big ask and a big sort of, we don't know if this is going to work moment. And the artists were very accommodating, very helpful. And, you know, everybody in the world was trying to figure out what was going on and how long this was going to last. And people worked with their engineering teams, or at least I found people worked with their engineering teams and worked with us, and were very understanding and very accommodating. And everybody just wanted to make it work. Everybody wanted to make it better. You know, I think the big worry at that time was this is going to shut down the economy completely. We're all going to lose our jobs. Well, those of us that are left.
Right.
So it's you know, again, I don't think they get enough shout out saying thank you for being accommodating to your engineering teams.
Yeah, the world did change overnight, and remote became more important. The cloud, all of a sudden, as important as it was the last decade, it became that much more central to people's businesses.
Oh yeah,
it's exploded in this industry. I mean, you know, we in our first week, I think we got hit up by 10 to 15 clients saying, "Help, we want to move into the cloud."
Nice. So in that moving to the cloud, I mean, I would imagine, like, what sort of challenges did you have? Like infrastructure wise, like how many iterations did you have to go through until you finally landed on sort of a set of products and solutions and technologies that really meshed well together and made the experience workable from a, you know, a remote or sort of cloud-based VFX shop?
Sure. I mean, one thing that I keep telling everybody is the cloud really is just somebody else's computer. But it also comes with an infinite scale. You can grab a slider bar and drag it up. And if you've got the pockets for it, you can get a really, really fast computer. So the way that kind of we decided that we needed to release this app selfishly was for our engineers. I had a very good friend spin up a facility on sort of day number one of COVID. His brief to me was, we need to be 50 people on day number one, all based around the world. We don't have any data centers. We don't want any data centers. We don't have any physical footprint. We don't want any physical footprint. So we sort of spent 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, doing what we had done traditionally on our old hardware in the cloud providers. And during that process was when I got hit up by a whole bunch of others. And I found, you know, I found certain tools that made it easier and certain tools that made it harder and whittling it down. But during that process, we got contacted by 6 or 7 clients to say, hey, we want exactly the same thing. And that's where I kind of figured out, okay, I think there's a product here. I think there's something that we can build for ourselves that our clients can benefit from. You know, and the whole point is to like abstract people out of the cloud console, because not everybody's cloud certified. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty scary place. If you open up console and have a look, there's a hell of a lot of things in there. And if you click the wrong button, you can do something really bad.
Or cost you a lot of money.
Or really expensive. Yeah, yes, right. Exactly. Or really expensive, yeah. So, you know, we've been developing this app for the last 2 years that I said is available in the marketplace. For vendors, again, it was, we contacted all the traditional people who we'd been working with. You know, PC over IP as an example, I had years and years of experience with it. I knew it worked. I knew what was possible with it. So that was a complete no-brainer for me. Storage was a bit like going back into the dating game, where I tried multiple vendors until I found you guys, until I found somebody that I liked and I'm sticking with.
There we go.
Cool.
And so what made you, you know, stick with Weka? Like what, how was that experience? How did that go?
So, there's a company in New York, who were quite early adopters of you guys, and, their CTO is a very, very good friend of mine, and we were at NAB. And he asked me if I wanted to come and join in a conversation with Weka. And I was like, okay, yeah, let me go join in. I mean, I'd heard about you guys. I knew what your clusters sort of did. Mm-hmm. All I knew that is that he gave me a bit of a demo and I had storage envy, which I never thought I'd have in my life. I was watching it going, damn, this is actually really, really cool. And like what's available, what's possible is really, really cool. And I kept thinking like, okay, there's a catch here somewhere. Like I've heard it's very expensive, or I've heard it does this, I've heard it does this. And I was chatting with Barbara from Weka. And I said, hey, just as an example, could you price out one of these for me with this throughput and this throughput? And she came back with a number and I was like, hang on, you're missing a zero there. And she was like, no, we're not. And I think it's just to the way how you guys, the big secret to me, or it's not really a secret, but the big advantage is how you guys read and write so quickly from the object store. The object store traditionally has always been seen as an archive tier,
yep.
Right? So you work on your data on your NVMe or your SSD tier, and when it's old and nobody wants it anymore, you dump it off to the object store and you just forget about it. With the tiering system that you guys have, I mean, we're starting to see really, really good performance directly off the object store. I'm sure that's always been available, but we've never really had an interface to the object store that I can plug a Linux computer on and go, all right, give me data as quickly as you can go. with a Weka, it gives you that interface and it gives you, you know, tangible numbers where you can say, all right, I'm going to read a file off of there and see what happens. And the numbers coming back, I was really, really surprised by. I was like, okay, well, this means this is possible, this is possible, this is possible, this is possible. And because it's on the object, it's really, really cheap. So, you know, I'm hoping you don't change your pricing model because it's really great right now. To the point that I've sort of tweaked it and whittled it down, and we really run barely any of the NVMe tier. We're really just using that for caching the metadata, and the rest of the stuff, all our clients are just reading and writing directly to object.
Oh.
And just super, super surprised with the performance we get.
That's actually one of Josh's favorite tricks is when he does a demonstration for customers.
That is one of my favorite tricks.
Yeah. He runs the entire demonstration off Object Store and then goes, now you want to see what it does out of NVMe?
And really exactly. Because there's nothing that I can do today to give me a good interface for my applications, like an application level, or basically NFS access, right? Or POSIX access. Like I want access that a Linux machine can understand, that my application can understand, that I can load up a file sequence, click play, and see what it does. There's a load of command line options for interfacing with the object store, but none of those mean anything if you're a Maya artist. You want to load up your sequence and you want to hit play and you want to see how quickly it plays.
Yeah, and more importantly, how smoothly, right? So you don't have a bunch of jittering and jittering and waiting for things to happen. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of our really interesting party tricks is that back-end object tiering, right? Like.
Yeah, so off the back of that meeting at NAB, I basically told Barbara after she'd showed me the rough estimate, I was like, all right, well, I want to get rid of my storage MV, like help me roll this out everywhere. And since then, we've replaced a lot of storage with Weka. It's been super impressive, super easy. The documentation is really, really good, I must say. Right before this call, I was actually busy rolling out a cluster for a client of ours. I've got the screen open sitting in front of me and it's just waiting for me to add nodes into it. And, you know, that's not a support call. That's me just reading the documentation and following it step by step and deploying a cluster all by my lonesome.
Yeah, one of the wildest things they saw is I actually installed a cluster for a customer and left. And then he decided to destroy it because he wanted to do it himself and redid the whole thing and had the whole thing built on his own using the GUI back then. This was way back when. And
absolutely. That's a good engineer. That is a really, really good engineer. You know, you don't want to rely on your partners. You want to keep those skills in-house so that when it breaks and it's 2 a.m. in the morning, you don't get an out of office from somebody. You know kind of what you're doing and how to fix it.
Exactly.
And that cluster has been running now for 3 years and supporting 120 DGXUs. Yeah, so
not bad at all.
Can you share his name? I want to see if he wants a job.
he's pretty happy.
No, I just recently had a customer like that as well, where we were like, you know, we were talking about, hey, we're going to run a POC, and you know, here's the documentation, here's where you go download the code. If you want to go ahead and pre-stage the code on your systems, that'd be great. And you know, next week on Monday, we'll sit down, you know, first thing in the morning, and you know, take an hour, and we'll get this thing deployed and ready to go. And that was like a Wednesday the week before, and like Thursday rolls around, and he's like, "Well, I have it up and running. It looks like I, you know, had a little hiccup here and there, but you know, I basically just read the documentation step by step, and it's up and going." Yeah. And I'm like, "Oh wow, okay. You're the first person I've worked with here that's just taken it upon themselves. Like, I don't feel like waiting. I'll just do it tonight. No big deal."
Yeah. The other thing that I'm really enjoying that I don't know, it could be a secret, I could get you guys into a little bit of trouble here, but is your support team's willingness to jump into a Slack channel.
Yes.
Yeah. I cannot tell you how beneficial that is.
That's a standard feature, by the way.
It's unbelievable. Being able to Slack with an engineer and share your screen and just say like, hey, I'm having this issue, and you get responses immediately. Yep. You know, all these systems that we roll out, they're in production, right? Yeah. People are working on shows, they have deadlines, they have deliverables. In this industry, you cannot afford one day of downtime. You can't afford an hour of downtime. If you're doing a delivery and it's that delivery is scheduled for Friday night and it's Friday afternoon, your cluster goes down, you have to get that thing up. Otherwise, it's an unbelievably awkward conversation with a client. And potentially financial ramifications. You know, if you're set to ship something on air and the agency's bought the airtime and you're like, sorry, we didn't get your commercial because our storage is down. Like that's just not an option.
Yeah.
It's just not an option. So
that would be an
having that access to support is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic.
The last thing you want is a 30-second segment in the middle of the Super Bowl that just says, my ad agency didn't get me my ad. Sort of thing.
Yeah. No, exactly. Or sending an email to support and saying, thanks very much for your email. We'll get back to you in 5 to 7 business days.
Yeah, that would drive us nuts too. So yeah, no good. So I guess, what do you see in the next few years with M&E? Do you see it more going towards the cloud, or do you see, you know, I think we've been talking about going to the cloud for the last decade or more. And people go, they put their toe in, they come back out. But we're seeing more people up there. But the on-prem doesn't seem to be going away either. So, I mean, what is it
you're saying? I personally feel like if you're not in the cloud today, you're missing something. on-prem is certainly still around. People still have cash invested in data centers and machine rooms and stuff that sitting on the books, and they still have IT equipment with leases and loans and capital expenditure tied up into it. And the cloud is a big, scary place, because if you just take your workload and forklift it up and pop it into the cloud, chances are it's going to cost more than buying that workstation under the desk. You really, really need to change the way that you work and change your whole mindset. You know, I said to somebody earlier, if you give me $10,000 to go out and buy a computer, I'm going to buy the best computer I can buy for $10,000. And I'm going to hit that $10,000 number. I'm going to try and squeak and tweak the components and make sure I get it at $10,000. Whereas with the cloud, you kind of need to start with $1 and slowly iterate up and slowly like see what is the smallest machine you can get away with for the lowest price point. Otherwise, you're wasting money. You know, if you go and have a look at like a high-spec machine traditionally. So, you know, we work with Autodesk Flames quite a lot. Now, they were multi-million dollar Onyx 2s that took up a whole machine room, or they were two racks, depending if you had a big frame store or not, would get commissioned by a engineer who flew out specially for it. You know, it was a big, big deal. And nowadays, a lot of people go out and buy their biggest computer they can get for a Flame, because they know they need that performance. When they hit play, they want it to play. But what happens when you're not using that performance? Like, all those CPUs are just sitting there idle. And if you start having a look at metrics on these workstations, like if you put a simple monitoring package on it, you'll see that they only ever burst up for like a minute a day. Or 30 seconds a day. Do they only really, really need that power? So, you know, one side of the coin is you've essentially wasted money buying all those CPUs for just a quick burst. Right. Whereas with the cloud, you need to build your workflow to be able to scale for when you need those 30 seconds, but for the rest of the time, whittle it down to where you're not paying for those CPUs to sit there idle. So, yeah, I guess that's a very, very long-winded way of saying
our clients are certainly... I was going to say the economy of the cloud is better than on-prem.
Yeah. So let me put it this way. So there's big fragmentation happening in the entire industry right now. Lots of people are splitting off, starting up facilities, and they get a couple of shots, and they work on those shots, and then they go, you know, go on holiday for 3-4 months and get new shots on the next feature and then pick those up. And it's a lot of hard work. It's very stressful, but there's a lot of downtime in between.
Right.
Now, that would never, ever have been possible pre-cloud, because you would need to go out and have so much capital to go out and purchase that equipment to be able to service those shots and do those shots. So those companies that have one or two owners, no private equity, you know, they don't have $5, $6, $7 million lying around to go out and buy these massive bits of infrastructure for a few shots.
Right.
Whereas in the cloud, like your capital investment is nearly nothing. It's a monitor and a couple of licenses and a Wacom tablet. So that I'm seeing a lot of. So it all really depends on your situation, whether you're going to stick on-prem or whether you're going to go into the cloud. I think for companies out there that aren't in the cloud whatsoever, you're definitely missing a trick, at least for rendering. You know, rendering is probably the most affordable thing to do in the cloud right now, making use of spot instances.
Right.
And you know, once you're rendering there, like, doesn't it make sense to put your storage and your workstations there as well and just remote everybody back? Everybody's looking at their physical footprint right now. Everybody's trying to figure out how many people are going to come back into the office. Do we need this 10,000 square foot facility? A fun exercise we did at the mill a few years back was we figured out how much a rack cost us in our Soho-based office, in our data center. And I'm sure I'm going to say this number, and somebody who's there who was closer to the project is going to say, like, no, it's not. But I think we figured out it was around £14,000 a year for an empty rack.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, before we had anything. And that's with your power, your air conditioning, your rental, you know. So having that empty rack was around £14,000. Now, that's a lot of money. You know, if you go in and build a facility that's 20, 30, 40, 50 racks, it adds up really, really quickly. When we built, I built an office in Chicago. And on day one, I think they had like 20 employees, but we had to build a machine room with 20 racks in it just in case. What happens if the company blows up? You know, what happens if we suddenly get a movie in? How are we going to deal with this? You really, you know, you sign a 10-year lease and you basically need to size your data center for anything that can happen within the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Or in 3 years' time, you're going to have a really fun project of moving stuff all around and trying to figure it out and, you know, trying to pull the ripcord on a few things. So to me, I guess I don't know. Very long answer is I just don't know. I know what I would do if I owned my own company, and that would be fully cloud.
It's interesting. Well, especially it's kind of an interesting topic of discussion with regards to how to, you know, cost maximize or cost minimize, depending on if you're on-prem, you have your own equipment, you want to try and probably cost maximize the investment that you have right there. You want to, you know, have as much in pipeline, have as much in standby waiting to make use of everything. So everything is as used as possible versus in the cloud where you just use as much as you need to and then cost minimize when you're not running at full speed.
Exactly. And that's the step that a lot of people forget is cost minimizing.
Right.
So you get people who get some really uncomfortable conversations with the cloud providers who get their bill at the end of the month and go, well, hang on a second, why is this so expensive?
Well, you let that P4D online for literally
exactly.
A month.
The answer is because you used it. Yeah. So, you know, you maybe can argue that you need slightly more staff in your technical teams to manage it. But in the same breath, you can have a central team who can roll out global infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually have seen a lot of customers taking up the auto-scaling groups and the alike in the other clouds as well to be able to provision Weka when they need it, as they need it to incorporate into their workloads. So it also, since we're able to shrink, we can deprovision Weka as they need it when they need it.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. I got to come clean. I'm a little bit too scared to enable the auto scaling. it's my last clutch that I'm holding on to that I haven't quite given up because I'm sure it works, but somebody's going to submit something to the farm that they shouldn't have. I don't want to wake up in the morning and we've suddenly got 100 node Weka cluster.
But it will go back down, just so you know, once the job's done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is at 100 nodes. It'll scare the crap out of you for those hours, though.
No, totally. I think that's purely just a me thing.
I actually spend most of my time farming our CloudFormation templates as well, making sure that people aren't leaving stuff running in the cloud. It's like, guys, your demo was an hour ago. Why is it still up?
Yeah. I mean, we have that, you know, we do demos of our product to people all the time. And at the end of the month, our accounting team says, all right, where's this? And I go, whoopsie, sorry. Got to click stop.
Why are there 67 instances of this still running? All right.
Yeah.
I need to shut those down.
Exactly.
Yep. I clean that up all the time.
Yeah, Bob is the shepherd of the AWS account. That's for sure.
Yeah, quite a fun, you know, recent-ish project we've had was we were approached by a film vendor who had no physical premise in a few continents, and we were able to provision them a couple hundred machines all around the globe from Los Angeles. It was me and three other engineers, and we scaled them incredibly quickly. Just something that never, ever would have been possible previously. You know, you would need an engineering team in each site, and then you'd need to get your mechanical and electrical contractor in to build your data center to size it. It would take you months to do this project.
Absolutely.
And we did it in essentially a couple of weeks. I think we got their Los Angeles office up and running first, which started off as, hey, we need five people running. You know, that old chestnut. And then suddenly five turns into 15, and 15 turns into 25. And then it's, hey, we need to get Mumbai running in 2 weeks. So we jumped on that and got that on board. And it was just a super fun experience for us. Nice. And again, you know, the hottest topic right now for all our customers is leveraging talent from all around the globe.
Yeah.
Very true. Yeah.
And that's actually kind of what we've been doing as well. We've been, as a remote company, even a different scale, right? Our talent pool has been all over the place because we can hire who's very good at storage and understands what they're talking about anywhere in the world, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other benefit of remote for myself as a business owner is I'm suddenly able to service 4, 5, 6 customers a day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not getting in my car and driving to Burbank and sitting with a single customer the entire day. Although it does take another skill of juggling people and making sure that the right fires are being put out at the right time. But I'm able to service a lot more and be far, far more productive than if I was, you know, at a single client's facility all day.
Yeah. And Josh, sure. And I can also attest to that because we basically are logged into a VPN at 3 different companies. Then someone sends us a teammate, somebody who jumps on a Zoom, and we jump from customer to customer across the world all the time. And it's fun.
Yeah.
That's the most fun that I have in this job, actually.
Yeah, chat applications are the bane of my existence. I have like 4 Teams accounts, like 20 Slack accounts, 20 Google Meets, like 12 Zoom accounts, you know, and depending on the customer's choice, like, I mean, I try and push everybody into Slack, but some people just won't budge.
Yeah, I was a little tough on Slack when I first started, but now I don't know how to live without it.
Yeah,
Slack is great. Likewise. Slack is great. I've been using Slack for years and years and years. My friends and I have had a shared chat that we've had going for probably about 10 years or so now. And we've gone from like Google Hangouts to Meet to Skype for whatever reason, and Slack and probably a few others in between. We always threatened to we're just going to use IRC, whatever. But we've yet to fall back to that. But that might happen eventually. Eventually, we'll go back to IRC. But
you never know. Yeah, exactly.
No one needs to go back to IRC.
Everyone needs to go back to IRC. At least have a built-in plugin so that no matter where you are, whether like you're using Slack, you're using Teams, you're using Google, whatever, you can still use IRC and use all of it at the same time.
That's the billion dollar company. Yeah.
Josh,
any interface you want, but connects to everything.
Exactly. But IRC always works.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I guess thank you very much, Tom, for your time, man. This was fantastic. I mean, it's great. Do you want to give any contact information where people can find you?
Sure. My contact is tom@gunpowder.tech, or you can email us all at info@gunpowder.tech. We're super, super thrilled to be partners with you guys. It was a complete no-brainer from my perspective. You know, and it all started off not by somebody selling me something, but rather me with my own eyes looking at somebody else's cluster going, ooh, that's quite nice. You know, so the product sells itself in my perspective, and it keeps the CFOs happy because it's inexpensive. So I think it's just a win-win-win all around, you know, and we're really looking forward to the future and just growing with you guys.
Awesome.
I appreciate you saying that, because I mean, a lot of the FUD out there has been that we're expensive, but that's the opposite of true. Just the, you know, those that playing game you have to play with procurement people have a high price they can discount.
I was under that impression until I sat down in that room and I saw the price for myself.
There we go. Cool. Perfect.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I guess for Cluster Conversations, I'm Bob.
And I'm Josh. And we'll talk to you guys next time.